Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And with Scott, as always, I am Tom Costera.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for December 22nd, 2025. All right, Tom, what are you going to kick off with this week?
All right, I got an article from We Live Security from the ESET research team. It's titled, Long-Nosed Goblin Tries to Sniff Out Governmental Affairs in Southeast Asia and Japan. So high-level stuff here. The ESET researchers uncovered a previously undocumented China-aligned APT group dubbed Long-Nosed Goblin. It's a tough one to say fast, Scott. I've been practicing and trying. It's not going well. They've been active since at least September of 23, and they've been targeting governmental entities in Southeast Asia and Japan, specifically for cyber espionage. The campaign uses Windows group policy abuse, and that's something I'm sure we're going to break into here a bit as I give you more info. But they use it to deploy malware and move laterally across domain-joined networks, enabling stealthy spread without noisy exploitation loops. So Long-Nosed Goblin's tooling focuses on surveillance, credential collection, command execution, and they do so using custom .NET apps and lulbins and lulbin execution chains to evade detection. The actor combines cloud-based command and control, primarily leveraging Microsoft OneDrive as well as Google Drive, with lateral movement via group policy to blend malicious traffic into normal enterprise flows. So going to some of the details here. So they deploy the tools across the network, leveraging group policy objects or GPOs, turning management infrastructure into a propagation vector that can evade standard lateral movement alerts. They have a few specific tools in the tool set that I'm going to kind of go through. So the first one that's mentioned is called Nosy Historian. It's a custom C#.NET tool that collects browser histories from Chrome, Edge, and Firefox. And it does so to assess which hosts warrant deeper compromise. So the intelligence is used to prioritize further intrusion efforts. And in recent campaigns, the group policy was once again leveraged to deploy a PE file or portable executable as masquerading as an INI file in an attempt to blend in with normal group policy activity. Once the history database files are copied to a temp location, they are then moved to a hard-coded SMB share within that local network. Another tool in here, the primary tool in this tool set, is the backdoor deployment of a tool called Nosy Door. So it's an advanced .NET backdoor that gathers machine metadata. So we're talking host name, OS, process context, things like that. And it communicates with cloud storage C2, so that OneDrive or Google Drive. Executing commands such as exfiltration and remote shell. Nosy Door is also distributed via that kind of group policy method. And this time it's masquerading as a registry policy file or a .pol. This file is typically distributed to the Windows Microsoft.NET framework directory. The dropper then creates and starts a scheduled task. And this task is responsible for starting the UEV app monitor, which is a legitimate C#.NET application commonly used in Windows. The catch here is that it starts it as a copy made from where it normally lives in the Windows System 32 directory. And it then leverages that tool as a lulbin. So in the report, this application is leveraged to trigger the app domain manager injection via a configuration file. It's a technique that can make the application built in make applications that are built in the .NET framework, which most of the payload is, allow it to load malicious code. And within the configuration, an attribute is set to disable Windows event tracing, removing the ability to see the logging for it. And then the app builds another application, which contains code to bypass AMSI, specifically using an open source red team tool called Inceptor. The app then decodes additional files that came with the dropper stage to bring in the main payload. So the main payload, the nosy door backdoor, again, is specifically used for surveillance, credential collection, command execution, and all of the bad things. So a couple other just small notes of additional tool pieces here that are mentioned in this article. There is a nosy stealer, which is specific to the credential and browser data exfiltration. Nosy downloader, which is an in-memory downloader and executor. And then the nosy logger, which is a key logger. They also leverage a reverse SOX 5 proxy, which helps support that persistence and covert communications. So, Scott, all of that, there's something, and I'm going to let you kind of bring it up and we can talk through it how the article referenced and discussed the group policy piece, because I couldn't specifically identify how they were leveraging group policy. I think we both might have some ideas of what they actually mean in this. But there was a couple things that I did pull automatically from this as far as possible things to hunt for and look for activity regarding or around this. So the browser history stuff, we've talked about that before, especially if they're going after the browser credentials, which the one tool set does. You can identify that in certain ways, specifically when you see things accessing those database files that live in those specific pathways for the given browser. The other one that I seen too that I thought really stood out is the leverage of the lulbin piece, where they were using that UEV app monitor, which is a legitimate executable. So seeing it leveraged outside of its normal directory and or copied to another directory is an automatic mark for me in my eyes for a dead giveaway for suspicion, right?
Yeah,
I'll take a breath, see what you thought.
Yeah, so as you were talking through some of the things, I was trying to do some additional, like, am I missing something for the group policy stuff? And I know we briefly talked, like, are they really using group policy? And just for like a sanity check, you know, I threw chat and say, like, is this group policy or is it something that doesn't look like group policy? And, you know, they clearly state in the article that they did leverage group policy. So that's interesting. Because if you're already leveraging group policy, like they kind of stated a couple times in here, that would imply you have domain or enterprise level privileges or some sort of delegated GPO access from some account that they could control. So it's interesting that they, I guess, took that path to some regards. But they did do a lot of masquerading kind of with things that look like GPO objects as far as how they, you know, stored their files, moved their files and things. So it's just really interesting. It's kind of like maybe a mix of both, which, I mean, obviously would be very hard to identify. But if you actually completely replace a GPO file and stuff like that, there are logs that get generated that could alert you to that. So a stealthier thing is if you have the access would be to modify a current GPO and add or change it a little bit, so you're not actually removing it or replacing it. But they didn't really make a call out there either, because I'm really fascinated by the GPO thing. Like, I always like to see how that's being leveraged in an environment, because, you know, I think how you manage an environment, there's guardrails that people can put in place, and a lot of times they don't. But I by no means am an expert for managing an entire enterprise environment. I'm just aware of the different, you know, bells and whistles based on investigations and things. But the one key thing you called out, I think, is the biggest sticking point for me out of everything I saw, was moving things out of system folders with lulbins and things. I think we've had a hunt pack for years, just looking for that behavior in general, because it's been seen before. And it's weird for, you know, something that, you know, to be running outside those kind of protected folders. But yeah, so it's really interesting, some of the things they have in place with doing the .pol files for the policy stuff, using INI files for configuration, even though they're not really configurations. It's like where they're dropping data or storing payloads. So kind of an interesting use of, you know, normal looking system things. I mean, obviously, this is a custom built malware. You're seeing it built in C#.NET. So it seems like not off the shelf stuff. So very purpose driven. So kind of this is how they thought out the attack. But like I said, it's it's really hard for me to wrap my head around this specifically, because I feel like we're looking at just a small segment of the entire campaign or breach or whatever, which is interesting, but I feel like it leaves a lot of questions unanswered. I don't know if that's how you felt.
Yeah, I immediately, as I was going through this article, for me, I still think there was a lot of weight to put here, but that part where there wasn't clarity on the group policy piece, and then trying to do sub research, because they stated that this group's been around since, 2023. So I was trying to find some historical things that might match up, and I still have yet to uncover that egg. So how they're leveraging group policy, we don't know. What we do definitely see, though, is that they are masquerading files to look like group policy files, and they're likely leveraging, the group policy cache directories to do things and stuff like that. So at least we know that. But either way, yeah, I think the behaviors that are pointed out in here do warrant value, right?
Yeah.
Well, I want to find that in my environment and have this little nugget in my head that says, well, they already have your whole domain, so you're hooked,
And they do make references to other security firms doing write-ups in the same group. So maybe pivoting from this to these other security firms, write-ups, things, you might be able to create a much more clear picture. But either way, they caught something they found was interesting, and kind of the layers in which they were implemented, this show like a more sophisticated, thought-out attack, clearly there to distill information and kind of sit there and maintain persistence, which I think aligns with typical APT activity.
Yeah, it definitely has the signatures of being PRC aligned, right?
Yeah.
All right, what do you got next for Scott?
So the next one is actually a Zscaler blog, and it's Zscaler threat hunting catches evasive Sidewinder APT campaign. So this immediately caught my attention because it mentioned threat hunting, and I was like, oh, I wonder what their process was as far as, leveraging threat hunting. Basically, they identified an espionage campaign that was targeting Indian entities. It was looking like your typical income tax department of India type of lures. And based on some threat hunting, they're able to identify activity that's typically associated with Sidewinder APT, also known as Rattlesnake or APT C17. And so immediately I was wondering, well, what behaviors did they focus on? So because I'm assuming this is more of an MSSP, they actually had some telemetry that I thought was really interesting that they kind of alerted on holistically across, I guess, through their monitor. And based on the campaign, they noticed a URL shortener that a lot of the people they must be monitoring for started all kind of going to. The same URL shortener. And that's interesting because a lot of times URL shorteners, if they're immediately rise where everyone's hitting the same one from different environments all of a sudden, that's a pretty good tell that there's something that's changed at least, right? And I think that's a really cool way or cool detection to basically turn eyes onto something. And what they did is when they saw that activity, they dug into it and they kind of reconstructed the scenario, were able to find the email, kind of walk through some of the files that were being dropped. In this case, they were using a living up the land of using a signed Microsoft executable Sense CE, which is associated, I think, with the Microsoft Defender, but it might be like the older one that may be vulnerable. And then they were able to sideload mpgear.dll, which ended up being the Sidewinder payload. This is interesting because it's already a signed Microsoft thing and it's associated with Defender. So if you're familiar with what you're monitoring for, that already looks kind of out of place or would look normal, but in the instance, the way they're running is out of place because it's running from user directories like downloads or desktop. They use a methodology, which I kind of liked how they broke it out. I don't know if I've seen this or maybe I have and don't remember it, but they call it tracer, which is when they basically find something, their job in their SOC response flow, whatever, was basically to triage it, right? Reconstruct whatever happened, analyze, which is, downloading more artifacts, looking in the infection chain, then correlate it. So in this case, they were able to actually use indicators they previously known to help tie this previous Sidewinder infrastructure. And then they escalate and then they revise. So in this case, when they talked about threat hunting, it was more like they found something that was worth investigating and had some sense of like almost creating their own intel to say, hey, we think we have Sidewinder activity. And at that point in time, then they started hunting for Sidewinder behaviors. So they didn't really start off with behaviors. It kind of started off more of a detection approach. And so this threat hunting kind of seemed more like your incident response processes. And that's why threat hunters and incident responders kind of overlap as far as capabilities and mindset. So just like where it's challenging when we talk about threat hunting, I think people would say, well, they're hunting for threats that they know are in the environment. They want to see what the span, scope, and everything is. So yes, by the nature of the naming and the words being leveraged in threat hunting, they are essentially looking for threats. But this isn't how I typically employ threat hunting. I would call this more incident response because what I would have been focusing on in this regard, URL shortener, I mean, I think that's a great for detection, but let's say you couldn't turn it into detection. That would be really a cool hunt. But the other thing that they mentioned is when the payload hit, there were specific geofencing behaviors. So we've talked about geofencing before, but basically there is some mechanism to determine whether or not something should or should not run. And it uses basically time zone information or IP to geolocation information. And if you're in an area that where things should work or should not work, it makes those determinations based on that. And there's a lot of malware, and this was common with ransomware that would do these things where it would hit like timeapi.io or worldtimeapi.org. There's other sites out there too that you can just ping against, and based on your IP and things, it will respond and kind of give you a output of where you are and what time zone you're in. And ransomware was really big about this because if people aren't familiar, there's a lot of ransomware groups operating out of Russia. And part of the kind of deal was Russia wouldn't really do anything with them as long as they weren't attacking Russia interests or entities, right? So it was very important they didn't accidentally strike something they weren't supposed to or agreed upon, and then they'd be left alone. So it was very common for them to use those techniques. And in this situation, obviously, they kind of probably used geofencing to make sure they hit an intended target specifically, but using the same behavior. So those behaviors that I'd already kind of be looking for, and you can turn that into detections too, because that shouldn't probably be happening. But it's good to know. It's good to revisit. That's kind of why I like with the threat hunting approach is a lot of times if I were hunting for something like that, I would be trying to add to, well, what other resources can be leveraged this way? So you're kind of keeping that up to date. But, you know, they basically were able to find it where users were directed, and then there were some redirections, especially with URL shorteners. There was a zip file that then later had the exe. And it was interesting too, because you had what looked like a document, the inspection document review .exe, which was ended up being renamed to Sense CE, which is that Microsoft file anyways. And so, you know, they talk about some of the detections. They even mentioned that if you have anything that has inspection.exe or inspection in the name that was worth looking at, which is probably not a common keyword in general for file names. And then there were some config files that were eventually pulled down as .inis. They had a my setup for a resident agent .exe dropped in C install directory, which isn't a normal directory either. So there's some things that can be noticed there. But overall, like, you know, it's my favorite part about this whole thing was, and this kind of like my jealousy of the data when it comes to MSSPs is, you can see and compare data sets from different environments that may have some association or similarities or commonalities that you can say, hey, these might be likely targets together or may not. And knowing those relationships, I think, helps you discover things like this. And just starting out with, hey, we just had a URL shortener just blow up across multiple clients, I think is a really cool validation for looking for something that you couldn't look for by itself if you didn't have the multiple clients per se, because you might not even have the volume enough to drive that. So that's probably my favorite part here, out of everything they put together. But then, you know, your typical change with DLL side loading, obviously you're going to see an EXE drop adjacent to a DLL within the same time, same folder structure, because that's how a lot of times side loading is taken advantage of. And, you know, going forward from there, there's some basic following activities, obviously the timestamp and geofencing type activity as well. But yeah, so those are like the key things about this that stood out to me. But I also always find it interesting too, like the threat hunting approach, like what's their mentality when it comes to that? And are they doing proactive threat hunting or reactive? And it seems more like a reactive approach too. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that harkens back to some of the old days, right? Like you...
I mean, we threat hunt like this, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not like digging on it, right? But, you know, it's just one of those things where I think you can get more, you can mature past that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, it's I think it speaks to the realm that we play in, right? So the threat hunting realm has variety and has different approaches and different levels of going after those given approaches. But those are pretty cool. I mean, I think you covered down on the majority of it. I did the one part I was kind of staring at and was interesting. Was around the you know, kind of the drop of the signed Microsoft Defender binary that they renamed to try to, you know, mask and get in there, but they also like use a decoy cert file to kind of like allow it to get in there to propagate to that DLL side loading trick. I thought that was really interesting. But most of the way you covered it all down, man, I don't have a ton to add to this one.
Yeah.
I do though, you know, I'll just re-echo it too, because I think it's a fun conversation. Just back to the days of the reactionary hunting.
Yeah.
But it's not that it's a bad thing. It's just that like, as you kind of go through it. Like,
well, I mean, you're going to have to do it if you find something that's worth doing it for, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But also like, how many times have we, you know, spent times, late hours of the day, late in weeks in certain situations where we would be in a place where we would be, you know, given intel, or there'd be some worry or concern about something that may infect our environment. And then, you know, then we're kind of like, you know, boots on fire going after looking for this activity in a given window. And then as we progressed through that, we understood that like, this is a better approach. And we started proactively hunting, those things would turn into detections. And then those fires would already have answers. We'd already have framework to give the scope of what we know and where we actually need to focus in a reactive sense versus just reacting to the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the evolution that's supposed to take place there, right?
Yeah. When we talk about like burnout for like a SOC analyst, you get like alert fatigue, right? Like I just got so much to the point where things just aren't important. Well, if your threat hunters are only doing reactive type stuff, I feel like that's their burnout, because you're kind of like at that, I got to have answers really quick. I don't know really what I'm going to find, but I'm supposed to find something because we think something's there, even though something may not be there, you know, or you have to like figure out how to build enough case to say, no, we don't have to worry, but you're kind of under that high stress mentality all the time. And I think that's like the burnout for a threat hunter, that you're just like, hey, we have something we have to look into. And it's like, okay, you can just find enough time and resources where I can say, can I just look into what I think is important for a second and see what that comes up with? Because it's more of like a low stress, and then it becomes like a more invigorating, because you find something that's worthwhile. You're like, ooh, I found something that no one else found. I'm driving the process versus kind of responding all the time. So,
yeah. Yeah. And also, just me personally, I think when I compare my experiences in both of those swimming pools of threat hunting, the reactive one, you know, while in certain situations it's absolutely necessary, but to kind of like baseline is that's your process, you also miss a lot of some of the underlying tissue of threat hunting and the value that threat hunting actually brings. And that's like in the way of knowing your environment better, because those reactive hunts, they don't really give you a scope of what you're really trying to find. You're just trying to find the bad thing wherever it might be. And you're going so fast, and you have to run through these different checks, and you're not doing you're not getting a full grasp on what's occurring.
Yeah, you got blinders kind of on, right? Like you're just kind of
narrow. And you're moving so fast that you also like questions don't always get answered. And it's not that you necessarily
can just stop and go slow, because we know that certain environments just don't have that, right? So there's always a reactive piece to the whole approach. But like missing things, moving too fast and not understanding fully what you're looking at, when you're reactive, especially when the boots are on fire and you're just going in that approach, how many things might you miss because you're going too fast, right? How many of the details that might be hidden or smaller details in a given intel report that you might look over that are like kind of the key cogs in the malware's ability to do something, right? But I think, yeah, the other stuff, like, you know, you're moving so fast, you're not able to learn your environment well enough, you face that burnout challenge, you're not able to establish understanding of your environment to better, like, you know, if you're going at a behavioral approach, you are going with that where you understand that your environment has those behaviors. So you tend to apply more of that depth of knowledge. You learn more about what's coming on. You can more confidently react to intel when you have a better posture like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. And another tangent from a metric standpoint, if you're just doing reactive threat hunting, a lot of times you're required to hunt for something that you don't know, like, if it's really there or not. So it looks like you're not getting value while hunting, even though you're validating. It's more of an instant response metric. You're basically saying, hey, and then really that comes back to is, what's the fidelity of your triggers that got you there? And what ends up happening is threat hunting doesn't turn up anything. So then it looks like your threat hunting is ineffective, when in turn, the triggers are what's ineffective, because you're spending time on things that may or may not be relevant. And when it comes to, you do find something, it doesn't necessarily mean you're really good at threat hunting. It means you're really good kind of instant response. So once again, I feel like if you don't draw those lines very well, then it's hard for you to improve certain areas in certain programs, because you're not kind of putting the weight in the right spot.
Yeah. If you want the real good metrics, the real good demonstration of ROI on your time spent threat hunting, finding your way to get to a model that's proactive, uh-huh, is going to yield you absolute golden fruits for, yeah, those types of things.
Yeah. Agreed. All right.
All right. Off that soapbox.
Yeah. We'll turn it back to you. What do you got next?
All right. So I have a article from Koi.ai titled NPM Package with 56,000 Downloads. Delivers a malware stealing WhatsApp messages. So the quick bullet points for understanding what we're looking at here. So there was a malicious NPM package that had over 56,000 downloads that was discovered distributing malware that targets WhatsApp desktop installations to steal messages and session data and more. The package exploited the trust and popularity of the NPM ecosystem to reach a wide audience, showing that Even high download libraries can be weaponized for credential theft. This is stuff that we continue to talk about. We will continue to talk about it, because it's absolutely relevant to our current environment. Instead of kind of an overt ransom or encryption, the malware's primary goal was information theft, particularly targeting locally stored WhatsApp session artifacts to hijack or exfiltrate user messages. So the backdoored NPM module, the attacker published a benign-looking package that included hidden malicious logic called Lotus Bale. The NPM package presents itself as a WhatsApp web API library, basically a fork of the legitimate WhiskeySockets Dailies package. When installed in developers' environments, the malicious code is executed as part of the NPM install or require process. The payload specifically looked for the local storage and session files used by WhatsApp, WhatsApp desktop specifically, targeting files and encryption keys that could allow access to message data. So some of the things that it was going to capture, or it's looking to capture, is the authentication tokens and session keys, your complete message history, so past and present, full contact lists with phone numbers, media files and documents, and then establish a persistent backdoor access to your WhatsApp account. This is where it gets kind of fun. So the backdoor leverages WhatsApp's use of pairing codes to link new devices to accounts. So basically, you request a code. WhatsApp generates you a random 8-character string. You put that in your device, and then you are linked. The malware hijacks this with a hard-coded pairing code.
which is encrypted and hidden within the NPM package, the malicious NPM package itself. This means that if you authenticate with that library, you are linking your application and the threat actor's device, giving them basically full and persistent access to your WhatsApp account with you having no clue that they're there. The package also has some booby traps within it, which this is kind of neat too.
Yeah.
So there's specifically 27 of them that they pointed out in this article. So these traps will freeze execution if debugging tools are detected at any point. So this includes debuggers, inspect process arguments, sandbox environments, and so on, basically eliminating the ability for dynamic analysis. So by the time it was discovered, the package had been downloaded for more than 56,000 times. It's really kind of underscoring that scale of impact. I mean, we say this all the time, almost worried that it's becoming numb because we're seeing this a lot more and more. And we're just like, here's these numbers of packages. And I still don't think the full impact of this attack vector is being spoken on loud enough, Scott, but that's just my opinion. The malicious payload executed upon module loading, meaning any code base or CI pipeline that imported or built with the package could be affected without any direct or developer awareness. And yeah, you know, with this article, it's kind of short and to the point about what we're looking at here. But I just wanted to bring this one up because we're going into the new year and I fully expect this is going to continue to be a thing for us. We're going to keep talking about this. We've talked about it many times this year, from smaller NPM packages or PyPI packages being leveraged all the way into the more louder ones that we've seen recently with the Shai-Hulud stuff. The supply chain attacks are going to continue. This seems like a vector for success, and it seems like many different threat actors are leveraging this methodology to get in your environment and execute under the radar. But yeah, keeping it top of mind, you know, threat hunting side, I can't really specifically call anything out on this one, but I do think, you know, all of what I just said, I think it's worth also mentioning going on next year. Keep that in mind, especially as a developer. You know, check your code, verify your libraries, your package installs, wherever you can. It's got to be top of mind, right, Scott?
Yeah, the thing that I think's the most interesting is when I see things like this, it's like the breadth when we talk about like how many downloads were of this specific pack. It's not, we don't get reported on like, hey, there was this breach because of this package and some company's reporting it or something's reporting on like responding to a breach. It's researchers going and looking and finding these packages and then looking at who's downloaded them. So we don't even really know the impacts other than like what these malicious packages can do, which is usually stealing a lot of data. So, I mean, like the impact is either not fully uncovered, disclosed, or unseen at this point. So I feel like there's a lot to be learned moving forward there. The other thing that I think is really interesting is a lot of times when you have I detect some sort of debugger or type of code built into places, it just causes the process to exit, which in a lot of cases is a trigger in itself that, hey, this is probably bad. And I even think there's YARA detections and stuff like that for, hey, process, look for this, it saw this, it, you know, and it kicked out and terminated the process or exited. This is interesting because the process doesn't do anything but just sit there. It's like, oh, I'm being debugged. All right, well, until you stop debugging me, I'm going to keep checking to see if you're debugging me. And when that goes away, I'll continue, or I'll just be in this infinite loop forever. So nothing really breaks, which is also interesting. So it kind of bypasses some other behaviors, what have you, to say, oh, it saw me doing something and it terminated. That's a good key indicator there's something wrong here. But the other thing, from like a threat hunting perspective, might be hard, but, you know, they're talking about how in this case, you know, they started off and I thought, I liked what they started with. They said, how do you usually find packages like this? They're like, oh, they're usually typo squatted, or they don't work. So they obviously sketchy, like you try them and it doesn't work like you think they're supposed to work. So immediately it's like a huge red flag. But because they forked a legitimate package and then added their code to it, and for people that don't know what forking is, it's basically saying, hey, I want to clone this, but I want to take another path, like a fork in the road. So now you can start developing the same package to do kind of more what you wanted to do versus going on the main trail. So you're taking that fork. But if you do see someone using a fork, like you're able to determine that, or you yourself are thinking about using something and you can tell it's a fork, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking the two sets of code and doing a diff to say, well, what's different? You know, there's tools out there that help with that. I'm assuming a diff would help you know when things started looking different, depending on what changes, but may not highlight all the changes. But that's a good place to start to say, you know, like what, obviously they made a fork. If they don't put it even a good description on why they forked it, you can at least see, not have to look at all the code, right? You can look at what code is just different. And then from there, if you're a developer, maybe you can discern like, this doesn't look right or whatever. So maybe something you can do to kind of protect yourself. But yeah, I agree. I think these things are going to keep coming up in interesting ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I worry, you know, like, you know, just referencing a callback to the, like the whole Shai Alut stuff. Like we still don't, I don't think we fully understand the depth of that potential compromise. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because so the way stuff like that works and the way that these packages and these libraries tie to each other and how things can get embedded in them and then just continue to be redistributed. That's why the worm was so scary. Mm-hmm. But I think even past that, like this target out the developer realm is, you know, it's kind of brilliant because in most cases, developers are running stuff. They're generally developing, they're testing, they're constantly trying new stuff. How often are they code checking before they do all that? Right. I'm sure a lot of people are, but I'm also can guarantee you a lot aren't. That's why some of this propagates the way it does, right?
Yeah.
So it's just we got to be aware of this attack vector, and it's you know, what's, if anything's taught us anything with some of the random exploits or vulnerabilities that we've had that touch some of the stuff on the npm side, or you know, Python libraries or things like that, like they're hard to dig out once they're hooked. So yep, keep your ears to the ground. We're gonna be talking about this more.
Yeah.
All right, what's last this week, Scott?
Yeah, so last one's just more of like a perspective piece, but also maybe some informative knowledge in case people aren't aware of it. But it's a blog from Resecurity, and it's called Dig AI, Uncensored Darknet AI Assisted at the Service of Criminals and Terrorists. Assistant for Service of Criminals and Terrorists. Basically, it's just talking about an AI, a large language model, like we're familiar with in general, that exists on the dark web, right? You know, it's got an onion-based address. It has no guardrails, and its kind of intent is to be able to be like an uncensored, you can ask me anything, and I'll give you whatever answers, you know, you want. And it's free. There's no, you know, buy-in or anything like that, like we see for some of the LLMs now. And they've seen where it's getting promoted all over the place. So there's different places on the dark web you can go to help kind of navigate, almost like, you know, search engines or forums to help you find other things. Because the dark web isn't like all mapped out per se, but like Pitch is an example where there's things that are there to help get things promoted. And so it's starting to show up as, you know, I guess highly visible. So it's not like some secret, you know, LLM that, you know, you have to know the right people or know the right place to go, and then you can use this thing. It's kind of just out there for people to use. And, you know, they have some examples in here of, you know, how you can or potentially use it and how there's no guardrails, like, hey, how to make explosives or a dirty bomb. It gives responses back. All type-based things, you know, here's all the materials you need, and this is how you should, you know, consider doing that, or basically how to potentially jam things and examples of doing things like that, you know, phishing, we've seen that in general, but, you know, ways to do phishing, how to basically create a payload, a malicious JavaScript with, you know, putting an iframe, you know, in place and doing things with that once you get access. So it gives you a lot of good details, right? That if you're trying to just figure out a few different things or polish certain things or just get started on something, just kind of like how I see myself using a lot of LLMs today as a security practitioner anyways. But why I bring this up is, one, be aware of it and be aware of when we talk AI and like cyber attack based things, it's still mostly used as a resource, right? And so it's basically saying, hey, if you want to be an attacker, we have a resource that can help you be an attacker. And this is where I hate where you still talk to some individuals and they're like, they're not allowed to use LLMs, or if they're using them, they're kind of using their own. It's like not like, it's kind of frowned upon in certain organizations still, especially when it comes, you know, and security is no exception. But this is easily available for people who want to come up with interesting ways to attack. And they're not like novel ways, right? They're just, they're ways that are well known and documented because LLMs kind of learn from those things. And it's just speeding them up from either the learning curve to, you know, just resource in general, whatever it is. And just want to highlight that that's why us as security professionals on the defensive side should be using them in a similar way. I mean, obviously we'll have some challenges because the guardrails kind of sometimes won't help us answer our questions the way we want them answered with the right details. But if you're in the security space and you're not leveraging them to some capacity, it's not, like I said, if you go into the intent of this is going to make my life easier and replace the work, it won't. Trust me, every time I've tried to do that for any work, I feel like I've had to do twice as much work because I'm fixing or finding things that I need to find myself because it just went off the rails onto some tangent that I was not wanting to go down. But yeah, so it's just kind of a cool article. It's worth checking out just so you can kind of get an idea of like, what does it look like from that side of things? They talk about some of the other criminal things that can get kind of scary and the challenges associated with that. And we'll probably see activity more and more like this. But I mean, as defensive practitioners with access to the things that we have access to, we should be on par, or I would say ahead of a lot of these attackers, because theoretically, we've had access to this stuff longer than they've had this, you know, unfiltered or whatever access to this AI type stuff as well, or large language models. So yeah, I was more just trying to kind of create some perspective there a little bit, but they also have some really good details as far as what they've seen from like real examples. So I thought that was kind of good to kind of find and share. So I don't know what your thoughts were.
Instantly angry for certain reasons, like just mad, you know, because, you know, there's people out there doing some of the stuff they're doing, leveraging these tools, but, you know, evil's going to be evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I personally hate that there's tools out there that like take all the gloves off and then people can abuse in all these really, really horrific ways. But from the cybersecurity perspective, this isn't going away. And
yeah,
it's going to expand. We've talked about various ways that there's different actors, different, you know, SaaS offerings that are out there, things that people are building, apps that are like wildly simplistic to use and very well developed, leveraging AI to do bad things, right? Not going away. And we have to be aware of it and have to start, in my opinion, Scott, we have to start calling it what it is and really breaking down, not just generalizing it as AI, but really breaking down into the vectors that are being leveraged, right?
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't, you know, I think we're going to, this is going to jump a strong percentage as we go in the next year, because we've seen so many so fast, you know, building tools to sell for people to, you know, run basic phishing campaigns or, you know, deploy certain malware things and, you know, even stuff that just, you know, works to do financial crimes. And they have apps that report it and the AI adapts and pivots and does things for you. And it's just, it's scary, but it's also like one of those things that we don't have a lot of safeguards for. So this is the world we live in with AI, right? So we just got to be prepared to take this on. But
yeah,
it'll be an interesting future for this, man.
I would draw a parallel to before AI, right? And this even like from a personal basis, I'm trying to remember when I came across Bloodhound.
Oh man, it was years ago.
It was like, I don't know, 2017, maybe?
Man, yeah.
Around then, right? And that was the days where you would read about attacks and breaches. AI didn't exist like it does, or the LLMs didn't exist. And it was all these GitHub repos of tools people were putting out there, and people will find them and leverage them from attackers. And defenders were doing nothing to locate them, find them, or test them, right? And it was like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. And, oh, what are we going to do about it? And I was like, well, we should learn how these, like, if people post something, we should find them as defenders, and we should learn how they work. And then, you know, how do we defend against them? Can we defend against them? All those types of things. And, you know, that Bloodhound was a great example that was like, well, this is an attack mapping tool. Well, I wonder if I attack map myself, what do I see as common vectors? What do I see as potential problems? I'm like, oh crap, I do see potential problems using the tool. I do see things we should fix. And it's just like, we just expect like, oh, well, you know, attackers don't play fair, or, you know, we don't have all the right tools. It's like, I mean, we literally have the same resources. Like, we had the same access to GitHub back then. And so we can look at all the same things. It's just who's going to do it first and who's going to take the time, right? And I feel like that's kind of where we are with this, like, AI race with defense and offense, right? We shouldn't hamstring ourselves because we inherently have to not trust things. We just have to start to understand things and be open to just trying new things, or exploring the possibilities. So,
yeah, and that's just the very quick soapbox, but it lends to this idea that, you know, maybe even an opportunity, because people's minds tend to reset, you know, at the beginning and the end of a given calendar year, right?
Mm-hmm.
But kind of launching forward, there's always been this traditional thing that I think me and you have crossed paths with, spoken out against, and generally tried to steer away from when it comes to the defensive side of cybersecurity, where, you know, there's pockets of specialties.
Yeah.
And I think over time, and you can correct me if you, or you can, you know, speak for yourself if you think disagree with me here, but I think we've always predominantly seen the ability for attackers to adapt because they take an approach by and large with having versatility in various areas. And I think for me personally, like, what I'm relating that to is when we're thinking about it from the defensive side, if we can just shape that little piece in our mind and our thinking for the industry and what we're trying to accomplish, having the ability to dabble in different pools of those specialties is going to benefit you far more than being really good at just one specialty.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's just based on the way that we structure our systems. And this is why the attackers will continue to win, in my opinion. It's one of the reasons, right? They'll continue to get through. They'll continue to find ways to break through it. And I think it's just because they're taking an approach of considering all these aspects, just like you just demonstrated with AI. They're considering leveraging X, Y, and Z, whereas we're a little slower to adapt that thought process, right?
Yeah, sometimes we don't have the freedom to tinker, right? I think that's important. Like, putting your hands on things and just, like, being okay to fail in a lot of ways is a good thing. I know, like, a lot of times, you know, if you don't have, like, a dedicated lab environment, either at home or even at work, you know, you're kind of hamstrung at that point, because there's certain things you may not try, because the last thing you want to do, especially if you get a black eye for security, is break something. And I think it's really important to have a little bit of that explorative freedom, because it goes such a long way for either you understanding your job and technology better, or understanding attackers and their technologies better. And I think that has to be kind of the norm for us to be effective in our space.
Yeah. And I think we need to teach it. I think we need to teach it to people who are coming up. I think we need to teach it in curriculums, you know, that thought process, right? Because you can apply theory to a certain point, but you got to be able to get in there and muck it up a little bit. You got to be able to, you want to be able to understand what it means to, you know, build a detection versus hunt, what it means to digest threat intelligence, what it means to, you know, like you mentioned, Bloodhound, like, be able to map an environment to understand where your weaknesses are. Like, all these different things can come into play together, right?
Uh-huh.
More collaboration, expand out of your specialty some, and, you know, we're going to start getting better at this.
Yeah. Live the big dream.
Off of my second soapbox. Thanks.
Yeah, no, we had some good tangents, I would say, so far. So, but with that, that kind of closes everything out. So I really want to thank everyone for joining us this week. I'm looking forward to syncing up back next week. So with that, that will close out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of December 22nd, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.